Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Labor and Employment Law Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, August 19, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on Friedrichs versus California Teachers Association. My name is Katie McClendon, and I'm the Director of Publications at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also note that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome our two experts, Bill Messenger, staff attorney at the National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation, and Dean Erwin Chemerinsky, founding dean and distinguished professor of law at the University of California, Irvine School of Law. A more complete bio of each of our speakers was provided to you in the notice of the call, so I'll stop here and preserve more time for their presentations, followed by your questions. With that, Mr. Messenger, the floor is yours.
Thank you, and thank you for the opportunity to address everyone. And what I'd like to begin with is just to give a brief overview of the issue presented in Friedrichs and the case law coming before it, just sort of set the stage for the future discussion and any questions. So the ultimate question presented in Friedrichs is whether public employees can be required to pay union dues or fees as a condition of employment under the First Amendment. And the seminal case on this issue is called Abood versus Detroit Board of Education, which was decided in 1977. And in that case, the Supreme Court held that employees could be required to pay for some union activities, but not others. Namely, the court said that employees could be compelled to pay for union collective bargaining activities and things related to that, but could not be forced to pay for union political activities. And so what the court did is basically draw a distinction or dichotomy between collective bargaining on one hand, which was chargeable, and political activities on the other. And one of the court's primary reasons for finding collective bargaining costs to be chargeable to employees is what's called the so-called free rider rationale. And that rationale is that because a union exclusively represents all employees in a unit in collective bargaining, it's only just that all employees pay for the union services as a collective bargaining representative. Otherwise, the court said the employees would receive a so-called free ride on the union's bargaining. So that was the basis of the decision in 1977. However, it did have a dissent by Justice Powell and several other justices, and they basically disagreed with the idea that there is a distinction between collective bargaining with government and political activities. And their position was there's no distinction between the two. Bargaining with government is a political activity and should be treated as such. But the Abood majority, stood. So since 1977, there's been a lot of litigation over exactly how to implement Abood, namely exactly which expenses are chargeable or non-chargeable, and the procedures that unions must follow to take fees for collective bargaining. And so now to fast forward the story to 2012, where things start to change. And that's in two cases. One's called Knox versus SEIU, and the other is called Harris versus Quinn. And in Knox versus SEIU, the question presented was whether a union could charge non-member state employees a special assessment for a political fightback fund that was used primarily to campaign against ballot initiatives without the prior consent of those non-members to the assessment. And the court held that the union could not. However, what Knox did, though somewhat of a change, are two things. The first is that the court, for the first time, was very clear that compelled union fees are subject to heightened constitutional scrutiny. It must be justified by a compelling and narrowly tailored government interest. And second, the court deemed Abood and some of its rationales to be, quote, an anomaly, and criticized some of those rationales. So sort of the first chinks in Abood's armor started to show in Knox. Then the next case up in 2014 was a case called Harris versus Quinn. Now, Harris versus Quinn actually didn't involve public employees at all. And the question was whether independent Medicaid providers who were employed by persons with disabilities but whose services are paid for by state Medicaid programs could be compelled to pay union fees under Abood. And the petitioners in that case made two arguments. The first is that they couldn't be compelled because Abood should be overruled, and the second, that even if Abood wasn't overruled, it shouldn't apply to them. And the court effectively chose option number two. In Harris, the court strongly criticized Abood and its rationales. In fact, it expressly listed six reasons why it thought Abood was wrongly decided, most of which turned on the notion that there really isn't a distinction between bargaining with government and political activities. However, the court didn't overrule Abood because it didn't have to. It found that Abood didn't apply to these non-member Medicaid providers and thus held they cannot be required to pay compulsory union fees. And so then, now moving forward to the Friedrichs case. And the Friedrichs case, certiorari was granted on June 30th, 2014, which was the anniversary of the Harris decision. And in Friedrichs, sort of squarely presents the question of whether Abood was correctly decided. The plaintiffs in Friedrichs are several public school teachers in California and the Christian Educators Association. And with the support of an organization called the Center for Individual Rights, they filed suit that flatly alleges that Abood was wrongly decided and should be overruled. And that case, of course, is now present before the Supreme Court. And the petitioner's primary argument is the one I referenced before, which is that there isn't a distinction between union collective bargaining with government and lobbying government, and that both are equally political, and that Abood's distinction does not exist. And then just to finally note that there also is a second question in Friedrichs, which is somewhat important, and it's known as the opt-in, opt-out question. And the question is, can a union seize non-chargeable fees, such as for political activities and such, from non-members only if they object to those seizures, or is the affirmative consent of the non-member required before the seizure is made? And it's sort of giving the facts of the case sort of makes that a little more clear. At issue in Friedrichs, the California Teachers Association basically says that every school teacher, it will take full fees from, including for political activities, unless they object to that seizure during a certain window period each and every year. So if a public school teacher who's not a member of the union does nothing, the union will take fees from that individual for non-chargeable purposes. Only if they object will it not take those fees. So the question is whether or not that objection can be required. And that's the second question presented in Friedrichs. And so that's sort of just laying the groundwork of the case before the Supreme Court. And with that, I think I'll turn it over to Professor Chemerinsky for his comments.
Thank you. I think I would begin where Mr. Messenger left off by being clear that there are two distinct issues before the Supreme Court. I worry that most people are going to focus only on the first, and I think there's a real likelihood that this case could be decided on the second. One issue, as Mr. Messenger pointed out, is explicitly whether to overrule Abood versus Board of Education and hold that the First Amendment prohibits school districts and teachers' unions from requiring teachers to pay the union their fair share of the cost of union representation services. And the other issue is whether the First Amendment requires that any government employee who wishes to join a union to opt into membership rather than, as the law currently requires, to opt out. I'm not going to repeat the description of the law that Mr. Messenger gave, the form that we had. What I was going to do is explain what I think the court should do in this case, and I'll just make a few points in that regard. First, I believe that Abood was rightly decided and should be reaffirmed by the Supreme Court. The rationale of Abood is that non-union members benefit from the union. They benefit in terms of their wages, they benefit in terms of their hours and their working conditions, they benefit in that they receive representation from the union. If non-union members didn't have to pay their fair share of the union dues that go for collective bargaining, there would be a real free rider problem. Now, I think what's important when we get to predictions is to note that Justice Scalia has been especially concerned about the free rider problem. At the oral argument in Harris versus Quinn, Justice Scalia repeatedly emphasized the free rider problem. And in 1991, Justice Scalia wrote an opinion in Leonard versus Ferris Faculty Association, and it was an opinion joined by Justice Kennedy, where he talked about agency free provisions are necessary because public sector labor law imposes significant responsibilities on unions, and the concern is that there would be a severe free rider problem if the union were unable to agree with the employers that all employees must pay for the services that the law requires that the union provide. And so the fact that Justice Scalia, both in a recent oral argument and more importantly in a published opinion, has stressed the free rider problem, I think is quite important in thinking about this from Abood. Also, when the Supreme Court decides whether to overrule a precedent, it spends a great deal of time discussing to what extent has there been reliance on the precedent. And Ubud is a decision that's been very much relied upon. Justice Kagan made the point in her dissent in Harris versus Quinn that literally thousands of contracts have been entered into between unions and local governments and local government entities that are based on the Ubud framework. And all distinctions certainly can be questioned, but there is a difference between the collective bargaining activities and the political activities of the union. That's the distinction that's at the core of Ubud. The collective bargaining activities of the union really do go to wages, hours, working condition, and representation. The political activities of the union are obvious things that they do in the political marketplace of ideas. We can argue that at times the representation they provide is a political dimension, and certainly political things can affect wages, hours, and working conditions. But the fact that a distinction has areas where it's hard to apply doesn't mean that it's a distinction without meaning. And this is a distinction that's existed now at least since Ubud in 1977, and I would argue even before that. The second point that I would make is that I think that this case is a particularly poor vehicle for the Supreme Court to consider, especially the first issue, whether to overrule Ubud, and even to the second. This case comes to the court in a very unusual procedural posture. What happened here was, right after Knox, the lawsuit was filed, and it seems clear from even the public statements made that it was filed to create a vehicle for the Supreme Court to overturn Ubud. There is no factual record in this case that since the district court was obliged to follow Ubud, it gave a summary decision in favor of the defendants. The Ninth Circuit did exactly the same thing, giving the summary affirmance. In fact, here the union asked the district court to allow a factual record to be developed, and none was developed. And Harris versus Quinn makes clear why a factual record is so important. In Harris versus Quinn, the Supreme Court said that there hadn't been a showing in that instance that the union was providing benefits to its members. In other words, the court said there was no showing in that instance that there was a free rider problem. Harris versus Quinn, the court said, was a very unusual type of situation. It wasn't one workplace. It was home health care workers that were hired by, could be fired by, the individuals for whom they were providing services. And so I'm going to quote the exact words from Justice Alito's majority opinion. He says, quote, no such showing has been made in terms of the need for having individuals pay the fair share of their agency fees. That then means that in order to decide whether there's a free rider problem, there has to be a factual record. There is no factual record in this case. Likewise, when it comes to whether opt-out or opt-in is the appropriate framework, that's really a factual question. How often is it that people who don't really want to be a part of the union are there because they forgot to opt-out? Or to what extent would just creating opt-in create a real free rider problem? Those are factual questions. The court shouldn't be deciding factual questions without a factual record. So I think this is a case where cert should be dismissed as improvidently granted, or the case should be remanded to the lower court to develop the factual record. Finally, with regard to predictions, predictions are free and worth what they cost. I generally try to avoid making predictions about what the Supreme Court's going to do, because we'll all know soon enough. By next spring, we know what they're going to do. Certainly are those who say, based on Justice Alito's opinions in Knox and in Harris versus Quinn, that there's justices who want to overrule Ubud. On the other hand, the court could have overruled Ubud in Harris versus Quinn. It chose not to do so there. I emphasize, as I did before, Justice Scalia really expressing concern over the free rider problem, particularly in his opinion in Leonard. And I think there is a compromise position available to the court. Rather than overrule Ubud, say that the non-union members have to opt in rather than opt out being the regime, following much what it said in Knox as to special assessments, and it gives the court a path to provide more protection for what it sees as the free speech rights of non-union members, but without overruling Ubud, a precedent that existed for almost 40 years.
This is Bill Messner. I guess my turn.
If you'd like to respond with petitioner's arguments, that would be great.
Sure. As I said before, petitioner's argument is primarily that there isn't a distinction between collective bargaining with government and lobbying government. I mean, in both instances, it is speech or petitioning, technically, intended to influence government policy. Professor Chemerinsky mentioned, collective bargaining involves wages and not policy issues, but wages, benefits, and other core terms of employment for public employees are in and of themselves a huge political issue. They affect the public budget disastrously in some states and can have a significant impact on tax rates, among other things. So the core parts of collective bargaining with government are just as political as some of the more controversial issues. And at the end of the day, union speech attempting to influence a school district or a state government of how that government operates is lobbying and political speech, irrespective if you call it bargaining or lobbying. It's the same thing under the First Amendment. The second argument that I assume the petitioners are going to make is to go after the so-called free rider rationale. I don't know exactly which argument they'll make. There's a lot of different ways to skin that cat, but just sort of throw out a couple of the potential arguments that they could make on that. The first is that, the free rider rationale sort of supposes that exclusive representation is this onerous burden upon unions, meaning that their authority to represent all employees is an onerous burden for which the union deserves compensation. But in fact, the opposite is true. Exclusive representation is an incredible power and a benefit to the union that only assists a union with recruiting more members and dues payers. The authority gives the union the power to speak and contract for all employees in a bargaining unit, whether they like it or not. And it also generally prohibits the public employer from dealing with anyone else, including the individual employee or any other group. In effect, the union is given a monopoly over dealing with the employer on behalf of a group of employees. And that monopoly is incredibly beneficial to the union and not a burden upon it. And that power assists the union with recruiting more members and dues payers. Employers are far more likely to join a union that exclusively represents them in the workplace than they're likely to join a union that does not. And so the free rider rationale sort of underlying theory that exclusive representation will make it more difficult for unions to retain members and recruit members, I think is the opposite of reality. Exclusive representation assists unions with gaining more members. The second argument against the free rider rationale is sort of similar to the first, in that the union's authority to represent all employees is not forced upon it by government against the union's will, but rather something that unions voluntarily seek for the reason previously stated. It's a great benefit. And so I don't think it's quite right to say that employees are going on a free ride with the union. Instead, it's a forced ride. The union is compelling them to accept its bargaining, whether they like it or not. And generally speaking, individuals can't be forced to pay or have no obligation to pay for services they never wanted in the first place. And then finally, the problem with free rider rationale is that it's not a government interest. So in order to justify infringing on an individual's First Amendment rights, you have to show there's a compelling government interest, not a union interest. And so, the idea that the government has an interest in ensuring that the union can collect dues is rather tenuous, because collective bargaining can exist and does exist in the absence of compulsory fees. For example, there are no compulsory fee requirements in the federal government, the U.S. Postal Service, and in at least 25 right-to-work states. Yet there is collective bargaining in all of those instances, at least in the private sector or public sector. And so sort of the notion that, compulsory fees are necessary for an employer, a public employer, to bargain with the union, is sort of empirically shown not to be true. And this sort of goes to the professor's point that there's not a factual record here, which I would dispute, in that the factual record does show, just by looking at the reality of right-to-work states and the federal government, that compulsory fees are not necessary for exclusive representation. So I think those are sort of a general outline of what the petitioners may argue. Again, exactly what they argue is, we'll find out in September. Going to the next point are some of the things the professor raised, the first of which I fully agree with is that, predictions are what they're worth and what you pay for them. And I have no idea, what the Supreme Court will ultimately rule in this case. I wouldn't read quite as much into Justice Scalia's concurrence in Leonard. In Leonard, the question wasn't whether Abood was correctly decided. Instead, the question was what kind of standard could you use to administer Abood, to sort of separate the wheat from the chaff, the collective bargaining activities from the political activities. And just as Scalia sort of proposed the duty of fair representation test to sort of distinguish one from another. But I don't think that necessarily means that he agrees that in the first instance, Abood was correctly decided. Because it does bear, you know, being reminded that Justice Scalia did join the opinion in Knox and did join the opinion in Harris and wrote Davenport, which also doesn't exactly have some favorable language towards compulsory unionism. But of course, at the end of the day, how Justice Scalia will rule, I have no idea, and I'm not even going to try to guess on that point. And so with that, as far as the record, is to go back and briefly touch upon that point, I don't believe a certiorari was improvidently granted. I believe there's more than enough record here. The complaint in this case, which is the record, included a large number of attachments, most importantly of which included the union notices that detailed exactly how they collected fees and how they spent those fees from non-members. And so the relevant facts are in the record. And to the extent there's not relevant facts in the record, it's sort of a chicken and the egg problem. Until the Supreme Court says exactly what it needs to either, you know, overrule Abood or not overrule Abood, exactly what factual record could be developed at this point. I mean, at the very most, if the court believes it needs certain facts, it should decide the case on that basis and say, you know, here's the new legal standard, find facts on that point. I don't think that it will. I think there's enough in the public record and the record in this case to support overruling Abood or opt-out, opt-in requirements. But at the very least, you know, there's sort of a chicken and the egg problem of saying you need a factual record to overturn, you know, what's an existing precedent. So with that, I think those are covers the main points that at least came to mind, and I think I'll turn it back over to Professor Chemerinsky if he has more thoughts, or to the moderator.
I think we agreed it goes back to the moderator here, though I certainly have more thoughts if that was the format.
I'm not sure.
You two can feel free to respond to one another, or let me know if you'd like to start the Q&A.
Sure. Why don't we, unless Mr. Messenger feels differently, why don't we start the Q&A, and I can respond to the things that he said that I disagree with as we go along.
All right.
Okay.
I will now open the floor to questions. You should hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star. To request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a second prompt that will say your microphone has been turned on. You have the floor. We will be answering questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone keyboard. We'll now go to the first question. Once you hear the prompt, you may ask your question.
This is David Applegate in Chicago. Professor Chemerinsky has mentioned the second issue on which the court has requested briefing, whether it violates the First Amendment to require that public employees affirmatively object to subsidizing non-chargeable speech rather than requiring them to opt in. Is either of the speakers aware of any Supreme Court precedent that discusses the opt-in versus opt-out issue, particularly as it impacts the First Amendment?
Well, of course, Knox versus SCIU would be a case very much about the difference between opt-in and opt-out. And my guess is that Mr. Messenger and I would both agree that that's what Knox is about, though we may disagree about what its implications are for this case. It involved a situation where there's a special assessment in California and, by the union, and the union members would have had to opt out with regard to that special assessment. And the Supreme Court, with five justices in the majority on this issue, said that the First Amendment required that they would have to opt into supporting the special assessment, not to opting out. Now, it's a much more narrow question than is presented here with regard to Frederick's, but it at least is the court speaking to the opt-in versus opt-out issue.
Yes, and I agree that, you know, this issue is definitely discussed in Knox. There's some earlier language from cases that, quote, dissent is not to be presumed. The Knox majority basically said that that was more of a historical accident, I believe is the quote they used, in any sort of deliberate decision, that dissent was not to be presumed with respect to, you know, requiring objections. But that language has been used by lower courts to imply that an objection is required. And I would also add that there's also sort of the second issue of the annual objection requirement. So most unions require an initial objection, not all, but some. But then the second step is sort of the annual objection requirement that you see from the California Teacher Association in Friedrichs, where they require that a non-member object each and every year during a single window period instead of just objecting once. And on that matter, there's a split of authority amongst the circuit courts about whether that's legal. Basically, most of the circuit courts have found that under the constitutional standard, it's not constitutional to require annual objections, but there are a couple private sector cases that go the other way, although the National Labor Relations Board actually generally considers them to also be illegal. So you sort of have the annual objection issue, and then below that, the single objection issue presented in Friedrichs.
Again, to ask a question, please push the star button and then the pound button on your keyboard. And while we are waiting to see if there are any more questions, I would like to announce our next scheduled teleforum conference call will be next Wednesday, August 26th at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. We'll host a conversation with Charles Slack, who's author of a new book, Liberty's First Crisis, Adams, Jefferson, and the Misfits Who Saved Free Speech. He'll be interviewed by Steve Klein of the Pillar of Law Institute. Please consult the full schedule of our upcoming teleforum conference calls on the Federal Society's website. And please visit our website to listen to podcasts of previously recorded teleforum conference calls you might have missed. Let's go to our next participant.
Yes, this question is for Professor Chemerinsky. Professor, this is Jim Young. Down the hall from Mr. Messenger in Springfield, Virginia. And my question is regarding the second question presented in Friedrichs. Precisely what compelling government interest is served by requiring individuals who've never affiliated with the union or have actually quit the union, what compelling government interest is served by requiring them to object to paying for more than they can legally be required to? Thank you.
Sure. I mean, there are so many levels which to answer that question, because you have to start with what's the compelling government interest to begin with? And then you'd have to even ask, is the compelling interest the right test? The Supreme Court has been so inconsistent in the compelled speech area. I think of the Southworth case where the court unanimously said it's permissible to require that students pay a fee to the university that's used for speakers, and there's no opportunity for opt-out, and the court rejected the idea of there being a First Amendment problem. I think of the Keller case where the Supreme Court said that bar members could be forced to pay the share of bar dues that go to support bar regulatory activities, but not the bar's political activities. And so one wonders, in light of these cases, what would be the effect on First Amendment law if the Supreme Court would overrule Abood? There's also the dimension of the role of the court relative to the role of the political process. Certainly states have the ability to adopt right-to-work laws. To me, what's striking about what's being asked for by the petitioners here is they want the Supreme Court to constitutionalize right-to-work laws and keep the political process from being able to organize itself the way that it chooses. Finally, in terms of the different levels that we thought of, is if one believes that there is a compelling interest in preventing the free rider problem, that the government can make the choice that in order to be able to represent employees, to equalize bargaining power, there can be the requirement of paying the fair share, then the question is, can that be effectuated by an opt-out rather than an opt-in regime? Is there anything unconstitutional about opt-out versus opt-in, given the compelling interest that exists in preventing the free rider problem? So those are the various issues that underlie the Friedrichs case.
Sure, and I just sort of address the issues of the constitutionality of the opt-in, opt-out regime, which I don't think I discussed before. And really there's sort of two arguments, on that point with respect to why the opt-in or opt-out requirement should be unconstitutional. And the first, sort of, there's a logical problem with them, in that if a union lacks the lawful authority to charge a non-chargeable fee, or let's say if a boot is overruled, to charge any fees at all, how can the union seize that money unless the person objects? In other words, how does the union have the authority to take an individual's money unless and until they object, if it's unconstitutional to take that money in the first place? Just sort of give a hypothetical to sort of illustrate the point. I can't just start taking my neighbor's property, say it's patio furniture, lawnmower, et cetera, until the neighbor objects to the taking. And the reason, of course, has nothing to do with whether objecting is burdensome or not. It's because I don't have a right to my neighbor's property in the first place. I have no, you know, ability to impose that objection obligation upon them in the first place. And so too here with unions. If a boot is overruled and the unions don't have the authority to take compulsory fees, or even if it's not, with respect to political fees, a union has no right to take that money in the first place. So it can't put employees in a position that it's going to take that money unless they object. It just lacks the authority to get it. So I think the opt-out requirements, you know, have just sort of a fundamental logical problem with them. And then the second argument that will likely be made against the opt-out requirements is the presumption, and that the union's taking advantage of inertia. Because the reality is, you know, sociology studies have sort of shown that most people will stick with the default if it takes an action to get out of that default. And so by allowing a union to take money from individuals unless and until they take an affirmative action creates a risk that many of those individuals may wind up paying fees that they voluntarily wouldn't choose to pay, simply because the union is taking advantage of the inertia, which in turn creates a risk that individuals are being forced to support, you know, political activities or others that they don't support. So I imagine those will probably be the two primary arguments before the court on the opt-out question, and we'll see how they rule.
Might I add here that the latter of what you point to is an entirely factual question. In fact, it's factual as you phrase it. You say many individuals who really don't want to do this forget to opt out. I don't know if that's true or not, and there's certainly nothing in the record of this case to indicate it, which is why I think this case is such a poor vehicle. In terms of the former argument, I do think it begs the question. Ultimately, opt out versus opt in is about where presumption is placed. And can the political process choose to put the presumption in favor of opt in and say, you can exercise your First Amendment rights, just choose to opt out, or does the First Amendment require opt out? And I don't think there's anything in the First Amendment that commands that the presumption be in one direction as opposed to the other.
We would probably go around in circles on it, but it'd be sort of similar to what I said before, particularly with respect to the first point, with respect to where's the presumption. If the union doesn't have a right to the property, in this case money in the first place, there's no presumption to place. It's the individual's property unless and until it's taken from them. And if the First Amendment prohibits a union from taking the individual's money, it can't require that they object. I think we're probably ready for the next question.
To remind you, to ask a question, please push the star and then the pound button on your phone.
Hi, this is Glenn Taubman in Virginia, and I have a couple of philosophical questions that I would throw out, primarily for Professor Chemerinsky, but I'll just throw them out and see what your reactions are. And the first one is, I noted that Professor Chemerinsky sort of reacted with horror that the Supreme Court could constitutionalize free speech in this context and say that, you know, it would be a bad thing if right-to-work laws became constitutionalized. But isn't that what the whole same-sex marriage and abortion debates have been about? Somebody says that something is a fundamental right, and it gets constitutionalized. So I would throw that out as one sort of philosophical point. Why isn't this a similar, important, compelling free speech right of people not to support organizations they oppose? And why shouldn't that be constitutionalized? That's my first philosophical question. And my second philosophical question is, Professor Chemerinsky talked about the benefit. People should have to pay for the benefits that they get from union bargaining. But what happens to individual employees who strenuously do not think that they're being benefited? I mean, suppose the union is negotiating for pensions for older workers, and I'm a 20-year-old worker, and I want my salary now, and I'm not concerned about my pension. So in that sense, I'm not being benefited by the union's bargaining. I'm being grotesquely harmed by the union's bargaining. So if I don't think it's a benefit, why should I pay? And so that my philosophical question is, who gets to decide in this free country of ours what's a benefit and what's a burden? And shouldn't it be the individual? Because after all, this is a free country, at least I've been told. So with that, I'll let you gentlemen discuss these philosophical issues.
It's a former question. Constitutional law is always about what should be left to the political process and where are the places where the political process doesn't get to decide. And liberals and conservatives always disagree about that. So a couple of years ago when the Supreme Court declared unconstitutional key provisions of the Voting Rights Act, it was the conservatives in the majority who were striking down the provisions, and it was the liberals who urged deference to Congress. When it comes to gun control, it's the conservatives who want to strike down what the government has done in regulating firearms, and it's the liberals who want to urge deference to the political process. When it comes to marriage equality, the example you mentioned, it was the liberal justices and Justice Kennedy who said that there's a fundamental right here, and we have to enforce the Constitution. It's the conservatives who say defer to the political process. So obviously there's always the question of, is this a matter that you resolve by the political process, or is this a matter that should be decided by the courts? And where Mr. Messenger and I disagree is, I think with regard to fair share of union dues, the political process works well and it should be resolved there. He would say it's resolved by the court as a matter of First Amendment law. Now, the reason I come to the conclusion I do is I think the compelled speech argument in this instance is very weak, and it's much more like Southworth, that all people here are asking to do is to pay for overall what is a benefit to them, much like the students in Southworth had to pay for the student speakers, even if they would sometimes disagree with the student speakers. And so I don't think there's a strong compelled speech argument. And I do think that there is, even if it's strict scrutiny, a compelling interest on the other side in preserving unions and preventing the free rider problem. So that's my answer to the first question. In terms of the second question, in terms of is the appropriate measure the individual, is the appropriate measure the group, and you leave out from that, of course, the union also has First Amendment rights that are involved. And how do we balance here the union's First Amendment rights, the First Amendment rights of the majority, and the First Amendment rights of the individual? Remember, no workplace is unionized unless a majority of the employees choose to have it unionized. And the question is, once the majority has chosen to have it unionized, then can fair share obligations be imposed on individuals who don't want to join the union? The Supreme Court reaffirmed in Abood what's made clear for decades. No one can be required to join a union. Now, it may very well be that an individual member of the union would rather not have certain benefits that are given. But, you know, I pay taxes for all sorts of things I don't want to see my taxes go for. We believe in majority rule. And overall, I think even the most conservative justices would accept that non-union members do benefit from what the union negotiates. They benefit in terms of greater wages. Study after study shows that about unionized versus non-unionized workplaces. They benefit in terms of hours of work, working conditions. And one thing they've got to remember, they continue to receive representation from the union. And so in all of these ways, the non-union members are benefiting. And that's why the Supreme Court has said, since Abood, that they can be required to pay their fair share. And I think the exact analogy is to the bar dues situation. Keller was based on Abood. If you can't force non-union members to pay a fair share, can you really force non-bar members to pay their fair share of the representation that they receive in bar regulatory activities?
I'm sure I sort of see a couple points that are worthy to address. And I think the first goes to the majority rule question. You know, as the professor said, you know, labor law and union exclusive representation is generally based upon majority rule. Now, usually that majority rule happened a long time ago. In many places, there hasn't been a vote for decades on whether the union remains the exclusive representative, because wins the vote once, it never has to win it again unless someone pushes for it. But leaving that aside, let's just say it was eventually, or in the first instance, based upon majority rule. But of course, the First Amendment was designed to protect individual rights against majority rule, to prevent the right to free speech and free assembly from being subjected to a vote of the majority on how they want to go. For example, you would never subject, to a vote, what church someone belongs to or what other advocacy group people belong to. The state of Texas couldn't say we're going to have a vote on whether the National Rifle Association shall represent, all gun owners in the state. Who you associate with, what speech you support, is an individual choice and one not subject to majority rule. And that's the core promise of the First Amendment, which is why I think that it's not a political question, but rather a core First Amendment question of, do individual employees basically have to support this particular advocacy group against their will? And I think the First Amendment should dictate that the answer to that question is no. And then second, turning to the benefit question, there can be debates about how much unions benefit individual employees or not. As Mr. Taubman made the point, a lot of employees oppose certain policies unions pursue, but others can argue that sometimes unions do things that benefit them. But I see it as constitutionally besides the point. It's up for each individual to choose whether or not they think the union is beneficial to them, and if so, they can support that group. I could argue that the National Rifle Association does great things for gun owners, and its advocacy protects their Second Amendment rights to bear arms. But I would never suggest that means the NRA can take money from all gun owners because its advocacy arguably benefits them. The benefit is not a justification for forcing individuals to support an advocacy group against their will. And then sort of the third point that I saw was sort of the balancing of First Amendment rights. I believe the Supreme Court addressed this point in Davenport. And in Davenport, the court made quite clear that unions have no constitutional entitlement to dues from non-member employees. It's only granted to unions by a matter of legislative grace. And then Knox sort of took that to the next step and rejected the idea of balancing the rights of non-members against the rights of the union, because quite frankly, the union has zero First Amendment right to take their money. The union may have a right to spend its own money and potentially the rights of its members, but as far as forcing dissenters to pay for its activities, the union has no First Amendment right to balance against the non-members' right not to be forced to pay for those activities.
Again, to remind you, to ask a question, please push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone keyboard.
This is Doug Seaton in Minnesota with a question, a more prosaic question, I think for Attorney Messenger. I apologize, but was unable to be on the first few minutes of the call, and I'm wondering if there has actually been a date and time set for oral argument on the Friedrichs case as yet.
Not to my understanding. The petitioner's briefs are due in early September. The respondent's briefs, I believe, are due in late October, which puts the reply brief by mid-November. So figure January or February for an oral argument. There hasn't been one set. I just actually looked before the call, and right now the court just has its October date set. But given that briefing schedule, I probably guess January, February. But of course, it's up to the court and how they want to do it. It could be sooner, it could be later.
Yeah, I would guess January. Cert was granted June 30th, which is the latest of any of the cases for which cert has been granted so far. And usually the cases that are granted towards the end of June are heard in January. The briefing schedule would be consistent with that. It could be pushed to February. I doubt it would be any earlier than January, though.
Again, our next scheduled teleforum conference call will be next Wednesday, August 26th at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. That'll be a conversation with Charles Slack, author of the new book, Liberty's First Crisis, Adams, Jefferson, and the Misfits Who Saved Free Speech. Please consult the full schedule of our upcoming teleforum conference calls on the Federalist Society's website, and please visit our website to listen to podcasts of previously recorded teleforum calls you might have missed. Again, if you'd like to ask a question, please push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone keyboard.
This is Bruce Cameron from Regent University School of Law. A question for both of these speakers. I've heard the Southworth case mentioned a couple of times by the professor, and my question is whether or not that is a reasonable precedent to cite to. As I recall the facts of that case, all of the student association groups were claiming and using the student fee money. And so there are numerous points of view that were represented by all of those groups. However, in the Friedrichs case and the Abood case, only the union point of view is being expressed. And so it seems to me that there is a fundamental difference between the Southworth case and the Friedrichs case.
I guess that question is directed at me since I'm the one who mentioned Southworth. The question is, when is the requirement for paying money a violation of the First Amendment? And my point is, there are cases here that seem to point to sometimes saying it does violate the First Amendment and sometimes say that it doesn't. In Southworth, all students were required to pay the student activity fee. Some students objected to that, and they said that the fees were being used to bring in speakers with which they disagreed, and they therefore thought that it violated their First Amendment rights. And the Supreme Court there unanimously rejected the First Amendment challenge and upheld the mandatory student fees. I would argue that this shows that there are instances where requiring people to pay money doesn't violate the First Amendment, and then we can argue over how analogous are the facts between Southworth and the union context. And here I think implicit in your comments and what Mr. Messenger said earlier is a perception that unions are an advocacy organization. You said the union, in the context of Friedrichs, it's only the union point of view. Mr. Messenger, in his answer to the prior question, referred to his unions as advocacy organizations. I fundamentally disagree with that characterization when you're talking about collective bargaining. In fact, I think that Abood draws the distinction between the collective bargaining activities of the union and the political activities of the union, just like Keller draws the distinction between the bar regulatory activities and the advocacy activities of the union. What Abood says is that people should be forced to pay their fair share because they benefit with regard to collective bargaining, but don't have to support the advocacy activities. Now, where I disagree, Mr. Messenger, is I believe there is a fundamental distinction there to be drawn, even though there are hard cases in the middle, and thus that's why Abood should be reaffirmed.
Yes, and I would just sort of go back to, you know, the original point is that I just don't see the distinction there between collective bargaining with government and lobbying it. I mean, so for example, if a voluntary association of teachers, or let's even say if parents, decided to push and petition a school district to adopt a certain policy, maybe it's pay teachers more, reduce class sizes, whatever it is, that voluntary petitioning would certainly be considered a political activity and protected by the First Amendment. And just by calling it bargaining and sort of institutionalizing the process doesn't change the underlying nature of the speech. I mean, lobbying is lobbying regardless of whether or not the government decides to set up a procedure to listen to that lobbying. And so I just don't see the distinction between the two. And of course, money to support speech, you know, can be expressive. Campaign finance law, or First Amendment law regarding campaign finance law, I should say, you know, sort of makes that point relatively clear, is that that's what supports the union speech in the first place, which actually sort of goes in favor of the union, not favor, but sort of coincides with the union argument that it needs this money, you know, from non-members in order to continue to speak on their behalf. And so I think the union's own position sort of creates this acknowledgement to some degree that this money is for, you know, an expressive activity on behalf of those individuals.
Thank you. Again, to ask a question, please push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone keyboard. And seeing no more questions, and since we're close to the end of the hour, I'll go ahead and close this out. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank Bill Messenger and Dean Chemerinsky for joining us today. Thank you also to our audience for the great questions and for listening. We welcome your feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Please do join us for our next teleforum next Wednesday, August 26th at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.